So anyway, thank you for coming to this session. My name is Lee Wiles. I'll be chairing today. We have two presenters on the panel who are going to be talking to you about the survey results. The first is Bill Bradshaw. He is a professor emeritus of Brigham Young University of Molecular Biology. He has published on the regulation of gene expression during development and also on improving student capacity for analytical thinking in biology. Our second presenter is John DeLynn. He's currently pursuing a PhD in psychology, and he is focusing on the nexus of religion and mental health, and among his other accomplishments are that he is the founder of the Mormon Stories podcast. Before I hand the microphone over to them, I just want to remind everyone to turn your cell phones off or to turn them on vibrate so as not to distract from what I'm sure is going to be a very interesting presentation. And hopefully we'll also have some lively discussion. And the presenters have said that if you have a question as they move along through the presentation, feel free to go ahead and ask as they move along. So without further ado, I'll hand it over. Thanks.
Several years ago, I attended a meeting at BYU that was for ecclesiastical leaders in the BYU states and wards. It was sponsored by the Evergreen International Organization, and the subject was homosexuality. In the course of the meeting, one of the bishops asked, how many people who have gone through the Evergreen program have been successful in changing their orientation, their sexual orientation? And the Emeritus General Authority who was conducting the meeting replied with the answer, hundreds and hundreds. It wasn't a successful answer for me. I'd spent essentially all of my academic life at BYU, 41 years in the classroom, many with in courses for non-majors in biology, and had sort of made it my watchword that we should learn what are the data, and there weren't data in the reply, hundreds and hundreds. So, fortunately, in the last year, I've fulfilled a lifelong dream in getting some of that data, and we're going to share that with you today. One of my students years and years ago was tall and broad-shouldered and very bright and very determined and opinionated, and we became good friends then, and we have continued that. Fortunately, I was able to enlist John in his academic work at Utah State to participate with me in a survey of gay and Mormon Latter-day Saints, past and present, and we're going to share some data with you today. There will be a number of slides, and some of them may provoke you with questions. To ask a question, please feel free to do that at the moment the question comes up. I'll do my best to repeat the question so that everyone knows what our discussion is going to be about. John's going to start by telling you how we arrived, the process that we use for enlisting people to respond to our survey.
Thanks, Bill. I have to say that I remember distinctly the day that I was driving home to Logan from Salt Lake, and Bill happened to call me and invited me to work with him on this project, and it was such an honor. And I had different plans for my dissertation, but once we started going, I quickly changed, and this became the work for my dissertation. And being able to work with Bill has just been a lifelong dream for me. So thank you, Bill. I'm really excited about this study. And I think one of the most exciting things about this study is the sample. I remember asking my advisor, who is a social scientist, you know, what N in the academic world, N means your sample size, you know, what N was she shooting for as a social scientist? And she told me 300 would be fantastic. And we were able to get over 1,600 people responding to the survey. And as you all know, sampling is critical in making a survey valuable. And so we decided to try and be a little bit innovative. And the first thing that I did is I called Jennifer Dottner of the Associated Press, and I asked her if she thought this would be a story worth writing to let people know that we are doing a study for, you know, any Mormon, past or present, you know, active or ex-Mormon, anyone who's ever been a member of the LDS Church who has experienced same-sex attraction, whether they identify as heterosexual or as gay or lesbian or whatever. That was sort of the people that we were drawing from, and Jennifer Dottner is willing to write that story. So this story went out, and we estimate about 250 print and online publications across the country and even across the world. And that was the first big, strong base that we drew our sampling from. And so as you can see, 22% of our sample came from what I consider to be, you know, as sort of a neutral of a base as you can draw from. We also went to all the LGBT support groups that we knew of, over 20, and we asked them to please advertise this study in their group. Another 22% came from that group as well. We did a pretty heavy word of mouth email and Facebook campaign. Some call this sort of the snowball sampling approach. 40% of our sample came from that. And then we also, you know, several bloggers, websites, and other internet forums advertised our study as well, and 11% came from there. And so, again, we were able to draw over 1,600 respondents, and we're super excited about that. So that's the sample. We'll just do some very basic demographics. 76% of our respondents were male, 24% were female. 91% were white, with 5% being multiracial, 2% being Latino, and 2% being other. So it is a heavily predominantly a white sample. Annual income is distributed, as you see. 25% of the sample, reported an income of $75,000 or more. We think that the socioeconomic levels here skew a little bit more towards the affluent, but we'll be doing some studies to confirm that. Education levels, highly educated, with a sample of 60, looks like 63% are either college graduates or have some type of professional or graduate degree. So again, it's and only 7% don't have at least some college. So again, it skews as a highly educated sample, and we haven't yet done the comparisons to national samples of LGBT populations to see whether that is sort of just right in line or a little bit imbalanced. So now I'll bring Bill up to talk a little bit about the sexual identity development section.
Question.
Wait.
Would you study just the age groups of the respondents?
The question is about the age distribution in our respondents. The youngest were 18, so the institutional review board at Utah State required that we have at least people of age 18. Our oldest was 74. The mean for men and women is close at about 38 years of age. Question.
And are these people that log on to the therapy process with that experience? Is this, are these people that log on through the therapy experience, or is this just anyone?
The question is, have all of these thoughts gone through some therapy experience?
Hey, Bill. Talking to this, if you're going to talk. It better be at the lectern. If you guys can come up and ask your questions on the microphone, that would let the listening audience also hear, if you don't mind.
The question was whether or not the respondents had all participated in some kind of therapeutic experience. And the answer is no. They vary, and we'll explain during the course of the talk what that experience was. So the slide shows you now
the average age at which our respondents experience various stages of recognition and acceptance of their non-heterosexual identity. For men at age 9, and for women a couple of years later, these people at a very early age came to the recognition that in some important way they were different than children of their same age. A couple of years later, they associated a sexual or romantic trait to that difference. Two or three years later, they described some sort of romantic experience, and at the bottom of the slide, you see at about age 22 or 24, they came out to one another. They came out to someone else or came to self-acceptance of their homosexuality. Recently, we looked at that subsection of our population who were under the age of 30, and 19 was the average age at which they have come out. So with younger people, there's a trend to become public and to disclose their homosexuality to someone else. These data are surprising to many in the LDS community who suppose that children of these young ages are not capable of understanding their sexuality. Not so. Significant numbers of our respondents report that age 5 or 6 or 7, they had a recognition of their difference. This slide shows you the distribution of self-proclaimed sexual orientation. So,
gay says 63%, bisexual says 14%, lesbian at 14%, heterosexual at 6%, and then other is 3%, which includes same-sex attracted as an identity.
There's an important difference between these data for our LDS population and for LGBTQ people at large, and that's the relatively large number of bisexual individuals. Also, as some of you will know, there is there's an argument about what one should call oneself. And there are a significant number of people in the LDS community who choose not to use the term gay or lesbian to describe themselves, and would choose instead a phrase like same-sex attracted. There are, in fact, a significant number of people in our population who self-identify as heterosexual, but then report to us their scores on the Kinsey scale of romantic attraction. It's a 7-point scale from 0 to 6, where 0 represents entirely, exclusively heterosexual, and 6 exclusively homosexual. And the average Kinsey score for romantic feeling for those who report themselves to be heterosexual is 3. So on the basis of their self-identified romantic feelings, they are, in fact, capable of some sort of romantic inclination towards both men and women, but do not choose to call themselves gay or lesbian. Question at the back.
So do the people who self-identify as bisexual, does that imply that they have some sort of sexual experience with someone of the same sex, or just...
John, I didn't hear the question.
Let me see if I got the question right. Does someone self-identifying as bisexual mean they've had some sort of sexual experience with someone of the same sex? Is that your question? My answer would be not necessarily. But Bill, why don't you also answer?
Well, we asked the question with respect to Kinsey score in 3 settings: behavior, attraction, and identity.
And we'll show that slide later.
Bisexual, someone who says they are bisexual does not say anything about whether they have an actual sexual experience with someone. So it's not very clear what the diversity of what behavior meant. When we ask it in the context of behavior, that may mean dreams, erotic feelings, how I feel when I look at a pornographic image, or it might have meant some kind of actual same-sex experience, but that's not clear. So here are the Kinsey scales. From left to right, 0 on the left, 6.
Can we explain this one?
6 on the right.
Can we explain this one?
Sure.
So we try to make this go left to right. So on the left would be people who indicated 0 on the Kinsey scale. We shouldn't have a lot of those in the study unless at some point they sort of had their same-sex attraction go away. So you'll see the red on the left-hand side be quite small. The top bar represents their feelings of same-sex attraction, like Bill mentioned before. The second bar going across represents whether they engage in sexual behavior or experience in some way. And then the third is their sexual identity, how they identify. And those are actually three separate things: your feelings of attraction, your behavior, and then how you self-label. You can see that for feelings of sexual attraction, the average is 4.89. So to the right of 3, you know, almost to 5, with 6 being the maximum. That's people's self-reporting average for same-sex attraction. For sexual behavior and experience, it's 4.3. So to some extent, people aren't acting out as much on their feelings of same-sex attraction, comparably to their feelings. And then for sexual identity, it actually goes back up to 4.7. So in our sample, people are relatively comfortable identifying as non-heterosexual, although there are exceptions to that. And what you'll see is that these Kinsey ratings tend to get bigger as they go to the right, and that would make sense, and that's why our mean scores are close to 5. And so people who label themselves as 6 or exclusively same-sex attracted, that's the biggest bar, that's that big purple bar on the side. And then as you go left, you see the bars sort of slowly narrowing. But you can see that over 50% of our sample label themselves as either 5s or 6s. So that would be...
Can you just clarify what 5 and 6 is versus 4?
Yeah. So a zero would be no same-sex attraction or behavior.
Just same-sex.
Sorry? That's right. No. Yeah. So 0 would be 0 same-sex attraction or sexual experience or self-identity.
For a man, 0 is straight.
Yeah.
And 6 is completely gay without any attraction towards
a
woman.
Yep. Is that interesting? Yeah. Are the Kinsey scores the same for male versus female? That's the first question. Okay.
And the second one, how does it compare to, say, another straight population
with the same graph? How do these Kinsey scores compare to a straight population?
These numbers are an average of our entire group, 1,612 individuals. And they are comparable to a random national sample. As we will show you later in the presentation, as we look at some subsets of our people with regard to, for example, their therapeutic experience, the numbers change. So that those who are successful in claiming some kind of change over the efforts that they have made to alter their sexual orientation, many of those people fall into the bisexual range of this scale and also self-identify by as much as 2 points on the Kinsey scale lower. So they may self-identify on average as 3.5 with regard to attraction, then their identity value is one. I'll return to that point in a few minutes.
So her other question about male versus female, if
the scale is the same for men.
And then how it compares to heterosexual samples.
And for heterosexual samples, these average numbers are comparable to a national random sample.
No, compared to just straight people. How do heterosexuals rate on the Kinsey scale?
All straight people do not give themselves a zero rating. Some of them who identify as straight will provide a Kinsey scale of 1 or 2, saying that they have some sense that they have some degree of attraction to the same sex individuals.
I sense your population of the whole 1600 is the United States. Is there any comparable survey of other cultures?
All the states of the Union are represented by 2 in our sample, and 22 other countries are represented. And large-scale studies of LGBT people in Australia, England, Germany, and the United States are comparable.
Should we go on?
Yeah. John, you take these.
So this is another one of those slides where we kind of are trying to show degree from left to right. So this is about disclosure. To what extent are our participants out regarding their sexual attraction or identity to friends and family? So left on the scale would be none. You know, red means they're totally in the closet. And then green on the other side would be they're out to everybody. Okay, so the extent to which green is there, they're out a lot, and the extent to which red is there, they're not out very much. And orange represents out a little bit, and yellow represents out somewhat, and then the light green represents out a lot, and the dark green to the right represents out to everybody. So there's 4 bars. The first one is to immediate family, and so what you'll see here is that, you know, about 60% of our sample is pretty much out completely to their family, and then about 40% are out to some or none of their family. So 60% out, 40% not so much out. As far as to their friends go, it's about the same percentages, 60% out to friends, and then 40% of varying degrees not so much out to friends. As we go down to classmates and coworkers, you'll see that people are less out to classmates and coworkers. About 40% are pretty much mostly out to classmates and coworkers, whereas 60% are either fully or mostly in the closet. And then as you see people with whom we're religiously affiliated, that's where you get people that are almost, you know, 60% pretty much fully in the closet, and then only about 25% disclosed. The summaries that I made for this slide are about 40% of your LGBT family members and friends haven't come out to you yet, right? So you only know 60% of your friends and family that are LGBT. And at church, you know, your fellow church people sitting in the queues, about 70% of your fellow church members who are gay have not come out, or you don't know about it yet. So you only know about 30% of the gay Mormon friends or associates you might have. Is there a question? Yes.
Premature question, but I was hoping that sometime, maybe getting towards the end, you could answer this question, given your initial bit in the presentation and all that's happening, including this survey. What cracks or what direction do you see the brethren starting to go? It seems like there's a mass and an avalanche of activity amongst the grassroots that are going to push this to make it much more acceptable at the top echelons.
Let's wait until...
Okay. That, we'd like to have that be kind of the main things that we kind of end on. Is that okay? So it's a great question. Noted. We're going to hit it hard at the end, I promise. Okay? Thank you for that. Yes?
No statistics up here on marital status and
Yeah, we're getting there.
Okay.
Yep. In fact, yeah, we're getting there. So we're actually there right now. So relationship status, 42% of our sample is single. 35% are in committed same-sex relationships that could be married, that could be just non-legally, but that could be
partners
that could be also domestic unions of some sort. 16% are married in heterosexual relationships. You'll also see that 30% were married at some point in heterosexual relationships. We'll talk more about that. 4% labeled, identified as divorced, and 3% as other. Now, here's where we get some interesting statistics. So I just said this before. 31% of our sample at some point attempted a mixed orientation marriage. And this sort of, have you guys heard of Josh Weed and the latest sort of discussion about him and how he's been able to make his mixed orientation marriage work? We wanted to just sort of talk about that a little bit, not necessarily about Josh, but about that possibility and sort of the probability and the risks of attempting a mixed orientation marriage. So again, a third of our sample, despite an average Kinsey scale of 5, has attempted at some point a mixed orientation marriage. 13% of our sample now is still in a mixed orientation marriage. And for those marriages, the duration so far is about 16.7 years. So that's the average length of marriage for those who are still in a mixed orientation marriage. That means a 57% divorce rate for those who attempted a mixed orientation marriage. Now, I had a friend write me and say, well, that seems low, right? It should be higher. And, you know, that's kind of what I would have thought, too. But then I thought about it. There are a couple reasons why maybe that makes sense. The first is that my understanding is that the divorce rate on first marriages nationwide is 40%, not 50%. And it's the second and third and fourth marriages that drag the divorce rates up to the commonly understood sort of divorce rate of 50%. So first marriages are 40%. So this would be 40 versus almost 60%, and that's a pretty significant additional failure rate. You know, you're 50% more likely to get a divorce on top of the already 40% chances if you're engaged in a mixed orientation marriage. But the other thing is that these marriages that are still lasting, you know, they're not over yet. They're right in their 15th or 16th year. For those who did, whose mixed orientation marriages did end, they ended around the 14-year mark. And so, you know, that's about when a mixed orientation marriage seems to be likely to end. And so for those who have been able to hang on, you know, the story isn't over yet. We're not going to wish them ill. We hope that all those marriages are successful if that's what the people want. But it wouldn't be fair to say that 60% is the failure rate. It might end up being higher once the story is fully written. And the last piece of data that we pulled together that we think is pretty significant, we ran the Kinsey scale scores for those who are currently in a mixed orientation marriage and then for the rest of the sample. And what we found is that for those, so the red line in the middle is the bisexual, it's the 3 on the Kinsey scale, so that's right in the middle. And what we found is that those who are still surviving or making a mixed orientation marriage work have a Kinsey scale score of 3.75, which is basically just a little bit above bisexual. The rest of the population have a Kinsey scale score of 5.1. And so it's pretty, and by the way, the p-value, if any of you are statisticians, the p-value of that difference is less than 0.001. And you need 0.05 to be a statistically significant finding. This is less than 0.001. So this difference is highly statistically significant, and it's what a lot of people sort of makes common sense to them, that if you're bisexual, you're going to have a much greater chance of having a mixed orientation marriage work than if you are almost exclusively same-sex attracted.
This is not surprising. Both LDS therapists and the published literature outside of the church suggest that those who are in the bisexual range of homosexual attraction have the greater
probability of making a success out of marriage. Beverly Shaw, a well-known Latter-day Saint therapist in the Los Angeles area, has made this observation for a long time.
Question? Debbie. So the question is, to what extent, let me see if I understand the question, to what extent are the couples that are in mixed orientation marriages out to each other, open about it, aware of it, talking about it, etc.? Yeah, I don't know that we ask that question so specifically, but we do know that over 60% are fully out to family and friends. So we have to believe that the majority of the of these couples potentially are out to each other, unless that subsegment skews towards the undisclosed. But my sense is that generally these couples are open about it and talking about it and working through it explicitly. Bill, did you want to?
We will show you the data in a few minutes about the attempts that this population of individuals has made to understand, cope with, or change their homosexual orientation. And so we ask separately for, with regard to professional counseling, engagement in psychotherapy, treatment by a psychiatrist, family counseling. And I just looked at the data where people who had engaged in family counseling wrote an explanation of their experience. And the overwhelming majority of the people in that cohort had not disclosed their homosexual attraction to their partner before marriage. So the counsel, in the context of counseling with a professional, they had come out to their husband or wife. And unfortunately, overwhelmingly, all of those people reported an eventual divorce.
Yes? Right. So let me see if I understand your question. Are you asking whether people that have decided to stay in a mixed orientation marriage tend to report more bisexual sort of Kinsey scores because they have some sort of self-interest in identifying as such? Is that your, yeah? And I think what you're asking is sort of the classic do statistics sort of report a correlation or causation. In other words, can we for sure say that score is factually representative, or is it more just an indication of people self-reporting and bias and other sorts of things? And it's a very fair question. I don't know what the right answer is exactly, but it's a fair question. Right. Right, yeah. Bill, do you have a response to that?
Well, the other way to sort of frame your question is how honest were people in reporting their experience? To what degree do John and I feel that we have valid reflections of people's real life experience in the data that we have? And we have to tell you that we believe that overwhelmingly people are being extremely candid, more candid than we would have believed. When given an opportunity to volunteer and to write an expression of their experience, people are writing a lot, and they are telling us very intimate details of their life's experience. It's been, we have come away from reading those thinking, believing that people have been very honest with us. Now we have no way to ultimately determine the accuracy, but we feel confident that these are honest expressions.
Just a couple more.
John,
Yes. 70% of our sample provided their actual name and email address to us. We estimate that respondents spent on average between an hour and a half filling out this survey. And in the 10 or 20 qualitative responses that people had the option of filling out, it's very common for people to have written several sentences in every one of the qualitative responses, and in some cases, multiple paragraphs in a single qualitative response.
Sometimes in excess of 1,000 words in a single expression.
So it's a treasure of data. John.
I just wanted to follow up on Bill's earlier comment. It sounded to me like what you're saying is that if one or both members in a couple did not know, have disclosure about one partner's homosexual orientation prior to marrying, that the likelihood of that marriage ending in divorce is much higher than if there was full disclosure?
That's true, John, but I don't have the data to confirm that quantitatively. That's an impression without sufficient evidence for me to be totally confident about it. There's a lot of anguish in that experience. I can say that without hesitation.
I was just going to say, I think that's an area that I would be interested in seeing more research on, because one of the assertions that's being made by some individuals now is that, hey, if we go into this with eyes fully open, both partners know what's going on in advance, that there's a much greater likelihood of our marriage succeeding.
I could not deny that expression from some individuals or say that those people were being disingenuous. But there are many, many more stories in our data set where the result of that experiment has been anguish and failure.
Okay. This is a finding that I discovered 2 days ago, and I was so excited about it that I was jumping off the edge of my chair. We offered five or six what I think is called, what are called psychosocial measures, measures of psychological or social or emotional well-being. So we assessed for depression and anxiety. We assessed for self-shame and stigma, for to what extent they have positive feelings towards, sexual minority identities, etc. And one of the measures that we gave was a quality of life measure. It's an empirically validated measure called the quality of life rating. And basically, what it shows is not sort of a pathological evaluation of how sick they are, but instead it's just overall how happy is their life, what quality of life do they have. Although it does reflect, if they are physically sick, that would obviously be reflected in the measure. So what we have here are a series of bars. Because the lowest extreme, goes down to about 60, I've chopped off, the bottom half of these bars so that you can see kind of the accentuation. Not with the intent to manipulate, but for the attempt for you to be able to see what the differences are. Because the truth is, the differences, a few points in difference can be quite a significant difference in quality of life. Because it's hard for someone to score below a 60 on this scale. So what you'll see here to the left is what the measure reported as being a healthy average. So if you're healthy, you get a 90 on the quality of life scale. And so that bar on the left represents healthy. And then quality of life starts going down from there. So if you're about an 87, that's sort of the rating that somebody with osteoarthritis has. And then if you go down a little bit more to kind of an 83, then someone with systemic lupus. And then if you go down a little bit more to 82, that's rheumatoid arthritis, and then psoriasis, and then fibromyalgia. And then the most extreme quality of life rating they had was Israeli patients with post-traumatic stress disorder. And that's about a 61 or 62. So that kind of gives you a sense for quality of life. And what we thought would be interesting would be to juxtapose people's marital status or relationship status with quality of life, and then compare it with these various physical ailments, because these are the baselines that the empirically validated measure provided for people to sort of try and do some type of interpretation of the score. And so we didn't do this to be sort of melodramatic. I was just, you know, we were just curious to see what would happen if we did. So what you'll now see, the blue bars are the ones that I've already mentioned to you, and then the colored bars are various relationship statuses. So if we're starting over on Israeli patients with PTSD, and then we go to fibromyalgia, the next marital status, the first marital status that appears is being a single LGBT individual. So being a single LGBT individual in terms of quality of life, according to our sample, is comparable somewhere between having fibromyalgia and having psoriasis. Now, I don't like to think of my LGBT brothers and sisters as single LGBT brothers and sisters as like their lives being that hard. Like, that was an interesting finding to me, and I'd be curious after I sort of walk through these if for those of you who know more about, you know, people who identify as LGBT, whether that makes sense to you. But that's where single fell, and then the very next option going up in terms of quality of life is a mixed orientation marriage. So mixed orientation marriages in terms of quality of life again fall somewhere between fibromyalgia and psoriasis. Then we go up one more, and that's a little bit more, and that's divorced or separated. And the truth is, mixed orientation marriage and divorced and separated have about the same quality of life rating, with divorce being slightly higher. And then we go to psoriasis and rheumatoid arthritis, and then we have unmarried committed to an other sex partner. So that's a committed same-sex relationship. It's somewhere between rheumatoid arthritis and systemic lupus. And then as we go up one more, we have committed to a same-sex partner. And then we go osteoarthritis, then the healthy average. And what was really surprising is something about being legally same-sex married put them over the average for healthy in the population. So they're actually healthier on average than the average, you know, healthy person in a broad population. And so there's something about being legally married to your same-sex spouse that makes you more healthy than average. And this, for me, was a very interesting implication, not just for someone who's considering a mixed orientation marriage. You know, that's something to consider, what quality of life, on average, you're deciding for yourself. And this is true for people who are devoutly committed to the church or not, as I understand it. Their quality of life ratings don't change whether they're out of the church or in the church. But the other thing that's interesting is, if we tell our gay and lesbian brothers and sisters that they can't get married, then we're automatically consigning them to a significantly lower quality of life. And then if we take that next step and point to them as a cautionary tale for how that lifestyle is unhealthy, that seems potentially not so humane, to basically say, we're not going to let you have the thing that would let you be healthiest. And then we're going to actually point to you and say, wow, you're not living a very healthy life. Now, I think that's a little bit of my bias coming through, but that's how I interpret these data. Bill, do you have other things you would want to say?
Only that Latter-day Saints have never really recommended celibacy as a religious state that's commendable. And to offer up celibacy as the only acceptable alternative to some of our brothers and sisters, with all its other defects, has the potential problem that John has just explained. I was thinking about this yesterday. When we greet people that we know and care for, we shake hands, we touch one another, we put our arms around one another, we enjoy being hugged. I'm talking about touch in a non-sexually intimate setting. consequence of not being able to have that kind of relationship to people apparently has a strong negative physical, mental, emotional consequence.
I'll also just add that for those of you who are statisticians again, the p-value of quality of life for mixed orientation marriage versus same-sex marriage is less than 0.001 again. So it's highly, this finding is highly statistically significant, as was the previous. Yes?
Those other sex, committed to other sex partner, those are same-sex attracted LDS people from your survey that are...
Yes.
Who the heck are they?
It's a smaller sample, but the question is the people who are unmarried but committed to another sex partner.
I see the pressure to.
Who is that population? Yeah. 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 You know, just human sexuality is, and human relationships are complex and diverse, and we see almost every different variation in our sample. Yes.
I think. You know, where the single is a lot of reasons why there are a lot of suicides. You know, because I'm gay and, you know, about 5.5 or 6. And that fits with me right now. I'm single and gay.
So, just to repeat, it's a gentleman who basically shared with us that as a single gay male, he can identify with some of those quality of life ratings as it being very difficult. Thank you for sharing. Yes?
I wondered if you screen for where people live. For example, a same-sex marriage is only allowed in certain parts of the country, and presumably it's more acceptable in those parts than it is in other parts.
Are you asking whether or not where so people live...
On this chart based on whether you live in Massachusetts or Maine,
right,
or whether you live in
right. So the question is, could it be that the high quality of life ratings for same-sex married individuals are heavily influenced or even predominantly influenced by where they live geographically? In other words, people in Massachusetts or Vermont or Maine are living in an environment where same-sex attraction and same-sex marriage is heavily accepted within the host population. And whether that could be an influential factor, even as much or more than the fact that they were legally married. Is that your comment?
John, do the analysis and call me with the results on Monday.
Okay. Yeah. No, it's a very fair question, and we don't have the data, but we're clearly not trying to say that marriage is the only factor there. So that's a question worth looking into. It's a great comment. Yes.
Well, I noticed that the healthy average that is exceeded by the same-sex marriage group, presumably that includes both married and single heterosexual people, right? And we could probably assume that if that were just heterosexual single people, it'd be a much higher number. And the more heterosexual married people are probably down there.
That's a great comment. I'm going to restate it a little bit, but it would be very interesting to see where heterosexual single people are on this scale and where heterosexually married people are. And I have heard studies that quality of life in marriage tends to start out kind of okay, but then go down as the children years hit and then kind of go back up in the later years. And those are all very fair comments. Yes, Joey?
I think that this is a great line of question, and I would suspect also not. I actually, my first thought was it would be a spurious correlation, not because of location where you live, but people that are most likely to get to seek marriage. Maybe there may be a correlation with
that's right.
Other things like income.
That's right.
The source of the well-being is not actually coming from marriage. I'm just saying
that's right. That's
a question.
That's right. So I'll just restate what Joey said. Joey is wondering also if geography isn't playing into this, but if it might be. Something to look into is a spurious correlation, which is a great word I'll try and remember, is the fact that could it be that affluent people or people of a certain education level are able to, for example, travel to the States where they can get legally married and then travel back to wherever? And in some way, could it be a self-selecting population that selects into marriage in the first place that is skewing the quality of life? Is that an okay restatement of your... Yeah, these are all great questions. I'm hoping it's not spurious, but certainly it's going to be a more complex set of factors than just one. Right?
Yeah.
Well, and now we have that, how much does the fact that they're LDS play into it? Because, I mean, the healthy average is supposed to be LDS. I mean, they want a set of, like not more, but raise a set of values and like work ethic and are largely white, affluent, educated people. So how much does that support as well?
Right. So the comment was, to what extent is there being LDS or formerly LDS playing into their quality of life as well? Is that right? And the only thing I'd say to that is that's true about all the colored bars, including the singles on the end. They're LDS too.
But even from this other study?
No, the colored bars, the only data we have on relationships are from our study.
Right. What I'm saying is that's compared to the healthy average.
That's right. I see. Yes, John.
I think this is really interesting to me, and I think it's worth pointing out that, a few years back when the LDS Church really started to emphasize celibacy, and they said, okay, we don't recommend marriage as a therapeutic step, and so on and so on, there was a lot of applause for that, but I think it's worth pointing out that if you have a policy that says the only appropriate path is to be single, you're essentially still pushing people into marriage, because if you look at this, they're going to say, I don't want to leave the church, I don't want to stay single, and this tells us they're going to be happier if they're heterosexually married.
Especially if the visions that they're given by, let's say, a Josh Reed example,
right,
makes them hope that their quality of life can be much higher than what the data actually report.
Right. So I think an interesting conclusion from this is that emphasizing celibacy is not going to have the effect of discouraging people from marriage. It may actually still be encouraging mixed orientation marriages.
Very nice.
John, let's move on.
Okay, this will be the last question for this slide.
Two other analyses for you to run for Monday. One would be, to what extent are those miserable single people out to family or friends? Or does that make them less miserable, which we'd all suspect it would?
Say that again?
To what extent are those single people out? How many of them are in the closet?
Right.
What extent does being in the closet contribute to that decreasing quality of life?
Okay.
And then the other one, I'm forgetting now, single in the closet.
Religiosity.
Yes, exactly. Are they? To what extent does church activity affect that? Are they going to church, marinating in family values? Does that make them happier?
Happier or more sad? Yeah, those are great questions. 35 minutes left. Okay. All right. You want to take over, Bill, or do you want me to
keep going?
Okay. So I put the word lifestyle in quotes. This is, again, me sort of revealing some data that reflect my passion for the subject and what I've been learning about it as I tried to learn more. So I put the word lifestyle there, knowing that it's a bit sensitive, and I left off the word that's commonly put in front of that, and I put it in quotes intentionally. But I just wanted to talk a little bit about the sexual activity of our participants. 51% of our participants are in committed relationships, right? So about half are in committed relationships. As far as sexual activity goes, 50% are sexually active in a committed relationship, 14% are celibate by choice, 18% are sexually active but not in committed relationships, and 18 are celibate due to lack of partner. Now here's where, so this is a finding that I think is also very significant. 18% of our sample is sexually active outside of committed relationships. I don't know whether that's interesting to you guys, but I kind of like that number. I guess that does show my bias. It probably even shows my Mormon upbringing bias. But, for those who want to talk about the gay lifestyle, 18% are engaged in sexual activities outside the bonds of a community relationship. Did you want to comment on that?
No, I want to take over.
Okay, okay, please.
John and I and our colleagues have just submitted a paper to the Journal of Counseling Psychology in which we report the results of our analysis of this information. And the research question is, to what extent have our people been successful in making some kind of change in their sexual orientation through the agency of psychotherapy, going to a professional counselor? We want to report that information to you now. A significant portion of our survey was devoted to attempts to understand, cope with, or change orientation through the following, through two levels of individual effort. One we called individual effort. People reported studying, reading books, going online, talking to other people. Another individual effort we called personal righteousness. We have story after story after story of people who have tried to who have utilized prayer and fasting and going to the temple and serving missions and being home teachers and in every way entering into a covenant with Heavenly Father that they would do anything if only he would take away their same-sex attraction. These two represent private individual efforts. And then there are professional efforts that include psychotherapy. Sometimes this means being referred to LDS Family Services or going to a private LDS practitioner or going somewhere to a professional counselor who is not a member of the church, or separately for psychiatry, or for family counseling, or for group therapy, all of which are professional efforts conducted by licensed professionals. And then we included efforts that were informal, such as support groups, retreats. And any other effort. Now, the slide shows you how people rated the effectiveness of these separate interventions. So, there was a 5-point scale. 1 meant highly effective, 2 somewhat effective, a rating of 3 was not effective, and 4 and 5 were relatively harmful outcomes as a result of any of these interventions. Two of the interventions had average effectiveness ratings that were in the harmful range. And one of these was ecclesiastical counseling with the bishop and stake president. And the second was efforts at personal righteousness.
John, the numbers don't quite tell the story. I want to read a couple of things.
I would pray to Heavenly Father to cure me of my attraction to other girls. This is one of my lesbian sisters. And the prayers were always ignored. By the time I was in my teens, I was convinced that Heavenly Father hated me and that I was not worthy to even pray. Before my mission, I attempted to be perfect, thinking that God would change my sexual orientation. So I read my scriptures, fasted, did baptisms for the dead, served on the seminary council, went to all my meetings, fulfilled my church callings. I also had a subconscious belief that serving an honorable mission would facilitate this, so at 19 I served a 2-year mission. When I got home, I was more confused than before.
So I continued to pray, fast, go to the temple, attend church, all the while pleading with God to change me. Pleading with a higher power to change your desires, pleading, fasting, discussions with church leaders, more prayer and fasting, going through the temple and adding another covenant. God, if I go on this mission, please remove the desire to be with a man from my heart. It didn't work. Served the 2-year mission faithfully. Came home and was engaged. Called it off as to not mess up my girlfriend's life. I was living a lie. I was trying to be a straight man. This person is telling me the truth. This person is not lying to me or fabricating. I was trying to be a straight man in the gay man's genetically created body. Get real. Seriously, I was gay and I knew it. Although outwardly you would think otherwise, inside I had same-sex attraction at a 10 on the scale of 1 to 10, 10 being extremely attractive. Honesty with oneself is a big deal. Honesty with God is a big deal. He didn't make any mistakes in creating human beings with same-sex attractions. People became ignorant on their own accord. All right, now we're going to report you now the narrower result of the outcomes of just psychotherapy, 1, 2, 3, 4, fifth down from the top on this scale.
Should I jump?
No. Let's stop. John, let's go to 3.6.
Where?
The average at which both men and women in our sample started psychotherapy was 22. But the distribution, that is if you plot on the x-axis time and you plot on the y-axis the number of people who went first to psychotherapy at a particular age, it skewed dramatically to the right. In our sample, there were people going for psychotherapeutic help with their same-sex attraction at age 30 and 35 and 40 and 45 and 50 and 55 and 60 and 65. These are people who have lived their whole lives trying to understand and cope and have not been successful and will try anything. And now, perhaps having lived a life in the closet and being unsuccessful in the private realm, as I've just read to you, they ask for the intervention of someone else. How long do people engage in psychotherapy? On average, 5 years in our population. But some people for 15 and 20 and 25 and 30 and 40 years, not always continuous and not always with the same therapist. People often report multiple attempts at different therapeutic regimes. Now, John and I read the responses of people who had engaged in psychotherapy. So, for just a minute, pay attention to the following numbers. 1,612 people in our total sample. 900 of them had engaged in psychotherapy, 56%. Of the 900, about 800 provided information about when they went, how long the therapy lasted, what kind of a numerical rating they would give to its effectiveness. But most importantly, 622 wrote something about their experience in psychotherapy. I read all 622 and I coded them and looked for any where there was any indication of change. And the standard was not stringent. We would accept anything that sounded like the person claimed that psychotherapy had made some kind of a difference.
with respect to their sexual feelings. Once I had coded them, I asked John to do the same. And John read all 622. And then we spent lots and lots of hours comparing our ratings. When we disagreed, we tried to negotiate them. At the end, we had 30 where we disagreed and found that to be highly acceptable level of rater compatibility. All right. 1,612 total. 900 who went to psychotherapy. 622 who wrote a narrative. Out of the 622, 542 of them had sufficient information whether, where we could determine whether or not there was a change that had occurred. 22 people out of 542. That's where that 3.6% number comes from. Now, the average Kinsey rating for these people who claim a change is 3.2 for their romantic attraction. For their identity, it's 1.1. 18 of the 22 are active members of the church. What did they claim as change? Let me read to you some of what we accepted as a acceptable level that something had changed in their orientation.
Question. Is the
psychotherapy? I'm sorry.
Is the psychotherapy,
is
that the same thing as reparative?
Is psychotherapy the same
as reparative therapy?
Not all therapists operate under a reparative model. So, reparative or reorientation therapy is focused on an attempt to change people. But not all of the people had a therapist who had that kind of a model. Many,
we have some data that's coming up that I can tell you a little bit about the difference between the paradigms under which the therapists were operating.
All right, but now what did people say? What did change mean for them? Quote, same-sex attractions have definitely lessened but are not difficult to understand and not act upon them. The emphasis here is on self-control, constraint, not necessarily an alteration in core romantic feeling. Same-sex attraction diminished, but never went away. It has largely helped me to increase my attraction toward women and decrease my negative reaction to my same-gender attraction. Helpful in overcoming my behaviors and seeing that these temptations and thoughts do not define who I am. So a significant number of the LDS-oriented therapists operate on the paradigm that homosexuality is a social construct, that you don't have to consider yourself to be a gay individual. Bill, you're not gay, you're a straight man who's a struggler. You're not gay, you're a person who has a problem. Some people lose their temper. Some people are can't focus very well when they're studying. You have this problem. All right. So, in the paper that we have just submitted, our conclusion is that claims for change in our population are very, very low, and the nature of the change is ambiguous. In fact, as we have then looked across all of the other interventions, the journey into manhood retreats, the evergreen support groups, the psychiatrists, we haven't found any more than 22 people. We have found no one who makes a claim that their homosexual orientation was reversed, that they have been altered from gay men to straight men, or from a lesbian to a heterosexual woman. Question.
There's a local therapist who shall remain nameless, but wrote a recent article for the Evergreen Journal who said that in his opinion there have been hundreds of people.
It's like the hundreds and hundreds I heard at the Evergreen conference that I referred to. Well,
do you want to share our attempt to get Evergreen to participate in the study, or maybe another?
Every one of the online groups, every one of the formal or informal organization that attempts to serve gay and lesbian Latter-day Saints, every one of them cooperated with us, advertised our survey, but I made three personal attempts with David Pruden at Evergreen, and he refused every time to participate in this, to have people in his organization's experience represented. Nevertheless, we have just shy of 100 people who tell us about their Evergreen experience. There's a question at the back, sir.
Of those 22 people who were part of the change, what was their rating, their Kinsey rating?
3.2 on average. The question is, for the people who claim change, what was the average Kinsey rating for these people? So exactly in the bisexual range of the scale.
And I believe only 4 self-identified as heterosexual. Is that right? Or is that... That's what I remember. No, that's of the people who...
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Okay, it's more.
9 of the 22 self-identify as heterosexual, but have Kinsey scores as high as 4 and 5. So there's this disconnect in the Mormon community. It's not a good thing to be gay among us. And so some people accommodate because their brains are built so that they have romantic attractions in both directions. And some people learn to accommodate by giving themselves another name that with which they are more comfortable. I want to tell you something else that I'm about to finish, John, so you can conclude with the things that you're feeling. I was inspired to insert into the survey a question which asked, have you ever had an experience which you attribute to deity, in which Heavenly Father communicated to you an acceptance of you as a gay person? This is not the same as, does God love all of his children? The answer is yes, in my experience, in my belief. But this is, does God love you as a gay person who doesn't need to change who he or she is in order to accept the fullness of God's approbation? I want to read another statement. I have had that testimony type feeling with my relationship with my Heavenly Father. Knowing that I'm okay and that I am loved for who he made me to be. I was on the verge of suicide. I just looked at all of our data, and tabulated everyone who made reference to a suicide attempt or to suicidal ideation. It's 10% of our total sample. I think that's a minimum value. Those were all volunteer expressions that suicide had been an unfortunate part of their life's experience. We did not ask a question, have you ever had a suicidal thought? These were people who volunteered. I was on the verge of suicide, driving to the West Desert to commit the act, when I heard a still small voice that I was loved, no matter what, and that nothing was wrong with me. And this man turned his car around and came home. Prayer in the temple and a distinct voice telling me I was made this way, and the only disappointment was that I wouldn't love myself for who I was. I would say that one of the most neglected aspects of this subject is the recognition that our gay brothers and sisters have pled with Heavenly Father, and frequently He has answered those prayers in the affirmative, that they are loved as they are, and that they are not required to make any change in their sexual orientation in order to receive God's full blessing and approval. I have read those expressions, and I wish to testify to you that I believe that they are true. They are accurate, and they represent one other manifestation of the goodness of our Heavenly Father to all of us. I don't know what kind of policy changes to expect as a result of the kind of information that we've communicated to you, the kind of formal changes we might see in the language and practice of the leaders of the church. But we need to stop the myths and the misinformation. Our gay and lesbian brothers and sisters do not choose their orientation. Nobody does. None of you in this room who are straight chose to be sexually attracted to someone of the opposite sex. I didn't choose to fall in love with that lady. She just bowled me over. I was irrationally in love with her, and still am. I didn't decide at age 10 that I was going to start looking lasciviously at girls. I did it all the time, and it was just natural. Nobody chooses their sexual orientation. It is false that someone is gay because of poor parenting. It is not true that you're a gay man because your dad wouldn't go out in the backyard and play catch with you, or was emotionally distant. There are many fathers of gay men who are emotionally distant. It is not a cause of the person's sexual orientation. It's a consequence of a failed expectation. When your son wants to stay in the house and wear his mother's high-heeled shoes and play with Barbie dolls and not go fishing with you, then unfortunately some fathers respond by being emotionally distant. It is not true that sexual orientation is caused by sexual abuse or sexual experience. That's a harder one to argue, because the level of sexual abuse in the Mormon community, in our sample, is anguishingly high, as it is across the nation. But there is no evidence that connects sexual abuse to sexual orientation in a causal fashion. Sexual orientation is not an inclination. It is not an addiction. It is not a proclivity. It's not... I only have 10 left, so I can't, 10 minutes left, I can't give them the biology lesson about testosterone and finger length. And we have a sexual orientation that we have because of the way our brain was programmed by steroid hormones while we were embryos. Very little of that information is internalized in the members of the LDS Church. I don't know what degree it is in church leaders at the highest level. I suspect that there is, that a lot of education is possible, is called for at that level. I know that the people who report their experience with ecclesiastical counseling, not universally, but almost always praise the bishops for their compassion, for their understanding, and then sorrow over the fact that the bishop was uninformed and didn't know what to do and didn't know the facts and would refer to LDS Family Services or Evergreen or something, and the experience turned out not to be helpful. Excuse me, John, I got carried away. Come on, you finish. Come and stand up. And gay people are not intrinsically unhealthy, mentally defective, subject to emotional difficulties any more than anyone else. The way we treat them has caused many of them to have serious, life's hard enough. Being gay makes it worse. Being Mormon and gay is really tough. We've got to change the way we treat our brothers and sisters, and then we will see a reduction in the level of mental health problems that they exhibit.
I want to just, I want to leave it at what Bill said, because I don't think I could add anything really to what he said that would actually improve the final few minutes that we have, but I don't want to leave off some of the religious findings, so I'll just speak to them really briefly, if you'll allow me. Something about what we're doing with our LGBT brothers and sisters within the LDS Church is proving to be catastrophic or failure to their religious or spiritual beliefs and practices. It's pretty commonly held in the field of psychology that the religion is protective. That, you know, we see that over 75% of the world's population is religious or spiritual in some way, shape, or form. And psychologically, that makes sense because we found that, people tend to live longer, to be less depressed, etc., if they have spiritual beliefs and if they even better are involved in a religious community. People of no faith sometimes may not be happy to hear that, but that seems to be generally accepted within the field of psychology. And just what this chart briefly shows is that before people acknowledge a same-sex attraction, 90% of them believe in God, 85% of them believe in Jesus Christ as the Savior, and about 78% believe that Joseph Smith was a prophet and accepted the Book of Mormon as Scripture. And what we find after they acknowledge their same-sex attraction, their belief in God goes from 90% to 70%. Their belief in Christ as the Savior goes from 85% down to 52%. Their belief in Joseph Smith and the Book of Mormon go from 78% down to 36%. Now, there are going to be multiple factors that contribute to this. But being same-sex attracted within the LDS context and maybe other contexts appears to be somewhat catastrophic to religious and spiritual beliefs. Again, Bill mentioned that 47% of our sample received some type of spiritual confirmation of God's acceptance of their same-sex attraction. What we also found was that 16% of our sample indicated a spiritual manifestation of God's condemnation of their same-sex attraction. But it would be interesting to find out why God's communicating differently to those two subgroups. As far as church activity goes, about 29% of our sample remains active in the LDS Church. So 71% either become inactive, so it's 36% become inactive, 25% resign from the church, 7% are excommunicated, and 3% are disfellowshipped. So about 10% are having some sort of church discipline enacted upon them. And then I'll just... And then there's various denominations that those who still attend church happen to attend. And again, 35% of those, they identify as either no church, agnostic, or atheist. That's actually 42%. So 42% just don't go to church at all and self-identify as agnostic, atheist, or just unaffiliated with any church and never attend. So... I don't want to rush through any more data, and so I just wanted to give you a sense for what it does to our gay brothers and sisters, gay lesbian brothers and sisters' spiritual and religious activities, and say we have to do better. I don't think that we should only look at this as a loss for them in terms of what they lose out on, but I think that, you know, once we get to know these gay and lesbian brothers and sisters, we also need to look at what we're losing out on when they vacate our chapels and our synagogues and temples. Because these are gifted people, not just musically, not just artistically, but spiritually and psychologically and emotionally. And to have them deserting our congregations in such massive numbers is a deep and significant loss to our faith community as well. So I just want to leave you with a website where we're happy to post these slides. LDSHomosexuality.com is the website. You'll find some preliminary findings, and we'll maybe post this presentation as well, and you guys can access it. I want to thank Bill for his wonderful, eloquent, touching, and incredibly powerfully scientific mind, and I want to thank all of you for coming. So thank you so much.